Okay, so, famous cases and what are the people's grievance? That pretty much takes the material of what was going to be 3 and 4 and puts it into 3. Let me make one correction. Sorry. I was on a rambling trail about the point that the First Amendment does not violate itself, and I wound up saying that both portions were 1789. I was just saying it was the same generation. Technically, the Bill of Rights was ratified in 1791. So, let the record show. My point is, it was the same dudes. Same generation. So, throw that out there. So I correct myself, 1791 on the ratification of the 10 First Amendments, the Bill of Rights. That said, famous cases and the people's grievances. So we're going to look at some cases. I'm obviously going to really be broad brushing them. The only point is to point them out. What was at stake? That's it. I'm not going to get into the minutiae of them. I don't have time for that. It's not a constitutional law class. It's an overall political science class. And then the shape of the people's grievance, the shape of judicial review, because I'm going to suggest that that is ultimately an instrument of the people's grievance. Again, even the judges are representing the people. Not in the same way the legislatures are, but they are interpreting in matters of civil law, which we have already proven are an extension of life, liberty, and property. In that sense, they are representing the people. So, judicial review is ultimately, and I mean this in a very non-communistic way, the people's grievance, okay, through that particular branch of government, the judicial branch. So, let that inform you. And then finally, the shape of governmental legitimacy, because that's going to, we're going to bring in the 9th and 10th Amendment and go right into that, ideas such as nullification and look at the American Revolution, stuff like that. I'm going to broad brush all of this. You're probably going to be disappointed and say, oh, let's go further into that. Well, that's what discussion time's for. We'll do that. So here's the big idea. Here's the big idea, and I really got this from Wayne Grudem. I just put it in my own words. His chapter on the judiciary is really, in a sense, what I regard to be his most passionate chapter. You can really get the flavor, and I don't disagree with him, that he believes that the appointment of federal judges, and in particular the Supreme Court justices, is the defining political issue. And you can see right away how that's the case. I think at the very least I'm going to say, okay, that's okay. The point he's making there, whether he inflates it or not, and I don't think he's really inflating it. I don't think he's pitting it against other things. But I think that's part of his point, is that you can't be a single-issue voter. Well, to take the most obvious example, and I've said it before and I'll say it again, you cannot be pro-life in an effective, objective way and not care about jurisprudence. Even if you've never seen or spelt the word jurisprudence. Your philosophy of law that informs the battle over the selecting of federal judges has everything to do with the position of abortion. Particularly in the main way that people have sought remedies over that in the past 40 years. It is law because of that issue. Improperly made law because of that issue. It can be most lawfully, or at least most peaceably, remedied because of that issue. It may be remedied through a bloody civil war, and we hope not. Nevertheless, on both ends, the creation of that law, hint, hint, a judicial branch creating law, and the remedies of that are 100% the extension of the selection of federal judges. You can't divorce those issues. That's the most obvious way you can't be a single-issue voter. Rant, but I'm just justifying what Grudem's saying. Here's my big idea for this last portion. To the degree that the courts are the most powerful political institution in the world, federal courts in the United States, the most powerful concentration of power of any institution in the world, to the degree that that's true, each judicial appointment becomes the paramount public issue in each decade or in each generation. I think if you put it that way, which I think is what Grudem intends to do, I think he's right. Well, let's look at a couple of cases and see how this shapes law or ignores law or whatever. Dred Scott versus Sanford, 1857. The question was whether slaves or the descendants of slaves were afforded all of the rights of U.S. citizens. Much like in the case of Marbury versus Madison, the court felt compelled to declare a congressional act unconstitutional. Naturally, the Constitution does not define citizenship in a way that was completely informative to this. But just as naturally, the free states defined those of African descent as citizens. The 14th Amendment made the ruling a moot point in 1868, but certainly it was not at the time. Treating this as a strictly constitutional matter further clarified the need for war to occur in order for the abolition of slavery to occur. Now, many believe that this ruling directly caused the Civil War because it clarified that. And I would say, and this principle applies to any institution, when words clarify something that's evil that's already there, well, then that's just one more check and score for the power and the value of words. If words start a war, so be it. If that war is over just cause. But you say both sides had an unjust cause also. I know. Okay? But don't strike that up against words and the principles of the Declaration that undergird the Constitution. Recognize that sinners are sinners and it's a mixed bag. Both the North and the South were fighting for something just and unjust. Let me just do that really quickly. The North was really filled with real abolitionists that recognized the Dred Scott case as against divine law, even if the Constitution didn't speak that way, and therefore clarify the need for war. And the North was run by people who wanted to use that situation to tear up the Constitution as strikingly, suddenly, and universally as Hitler did with the burning of the Reichstag and tearing up the German Constitution. Both true. That's the kind of world we live in. It's a mixed bag. The South, and the army was filled with 80% of people who did not own slaves and never did. And who, following John Calhoun of South Carolina, were fighting for the principle of nullification. And to maintain that constitutionally as a legal matter, even if it was fought in that case over. So it's also the case that, and you can show this from quotes from the leaders of the states of the southern states, that they were also fighting for maintaining slavery. It's a mixed bag. Okay? So you can't just take side. And first of all, you live up to the caricature of all those pietists who say, you see, the American Revolution was unjustified biblically. And they'll point to Samuel Adams and say, and so the very meaning of the word it undergoes a radical change. Can it be justified? Question, what do you mean by it? Do you mean the particular sins and motives of those particular people? You say, well, Matt, you're qualifying it so much that the way you're having it, you're agreeing with me that every single member of the Constitutional Convention, or sorry, of the original Articles of Confederation and the people that fought that war had unjust motives. Therefore, it was unjust. Okay, it's called the fallacy of equivocation in logic. You're changing the meaning of the word it from whether such an action is just to whether those guys did it the right way. And I don't accept that equation. That's relativism. That's anti-truth. I don't accept that. Anyway, Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. This is the famous case that upheld the doctrine of separate but equal. Not simply upholding a right to segregate in private, but a right of the state to separate on public property. Well, one of the arguments was that this violated the 14th Amendment and so forth. Matter of fact, I haven't read that yet. The 14th Amendment, which is really the principal amendment that the judges that started to show up under Roosevelt's court packing plan. Come on, find before you talk. 14, 15, there we are. No, I keep skipping it. I have chalk in my fingers. 15, I keep going from 13 to 15. Something's happening here. Is there a page missing? Or am I just not hitting it? Wow. Page 83 to 84. What am I missing? Am I crazy? Or does this book go right from 13 to 15? Am I crazy?
It's demonic.
This is a postmodern constitution. Give me another book. He ripped it out of... That's the one I've had... Anyway, whatever. Let me just use this book. It doesn't even include the 14th Amendment. Hold on here. It's a postmodern constitution. It's a progressivist book. You think they...
No.
Where? Oh, it's on the top of the page. That looked like a... That looked like one of those, you know, page heading things. Okay, there we go. Whew! Okay, thought I was going crazy. There we go. All right, section one. all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Aha, so there's a strike against the argument that this state can do it this way, this state can do it this way. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges or immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of the law, nor deny to any person within its jurisdiction the equal protection of the law. Stop. Do you see how that can start to create the flip-flopping of the meaning of the whole Constitution? What's the principal difference between the language there, the state shall not, the state shall not, as opposed to what you've seen so far? Right. So here's the Constitution. It looks for the first time as if the feds are using the Constitution as an arm of saying to us, you shall not do this. In a sense, they're saying, I agree with everything else this document says, but there are some things so evil, and you are just the people that can do it. You know, if you just would have added the words, Congress shall not deny, and so forth, there's a lot of different ways you could have said all the same things without doing that. So, you know, there's a lot of debate here. There can be a debate about the wording of it, or there can be a debate about the meaning of it that they certainly didn't mean. And I would say one thing, even in the language that it has right now, there certainly wasn't any thought of going back on the meaning. The 14th Amendment was there to do what it says. I mean, it's straightforward. It's because things such as life, liberty, and property, things that are already there, in a sense they were saying to the states, and this means you too. Okay? So they're closing a loophole. Well, it started to be interpreted as if it was the point at which it starts to turn the rest of the Constitution inside out. The 14th Amendment became, after Roosevelt's court and the Warren court and whoever's before that, became this point in the Constitution that you could grab. You can't see this if you're listening on audio. I got my hand here and my right hand is reaching down into, and you can pull it and turn the whole thing inside out. The 14th Amendment became the thing that started to set the Constitution on its head, to be speaking down to the states and the people. And some people are okay with that. We say, well, those people need to be talked down to. Those people in Mississippi and Alabama who, I can't trust those judges to give equal due protection and so on and so forth. So you see what's happening here in the mindset. Well, in 1954, Brown versus the Board of Education, this is the decision that overturned Plessy versus Ferguson. It was applied to segregation in educational institutions in particular, and the Warren Court delivered a 9-0 verdict. The ground was that such laws violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Prior to this, it was argued that such separate provisions did not violate the 14th Amendment because separate provisions, even if unequal in quality, is nevertheless not the same thing as protection. Okay? And I've heard people actually argue that, yeah, we want those things, and there's another way to allow for that equal protection without equating provision to protection. Because I don't think, there's a lot of people that support Brown's Board of Education, and the line is, well, it's because they were public institutions. We're not denying that a business can refuse service to this or whatever. Although even there, the Commerce Clause started to be asserted to private businesses, particularly when those businesses were along an interstate. So interstates are in states, and so they would assert the Commerce Clause as a means of saying, you have to serve all people equally. And at first you're like, well, that's a good thing, because that just, you know, blah, 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 blah. But that can become a slippery slope where anywhere near an interstate, a private assembly has to essentially not be an objectively defined entity at all. It's one thing if it's a truck stop or something else and you're protecting people equally, as opposed to saying that nobody can define, in other words, to set the 14th Amendment against the First Amendment. Okay? That's when you know you're not applying it properly. And my argument here is not that Brown versus the Board of Education did that. I'm just showing you the kind of battle, the kind of argument that stuff starts to seep in. So here's another one, Lemon versus Kurtzman, 1971. And we've already talked about this one, about the Establishment versus the Expression Clause, but the government must not have the primary effect of either advancing or inhibiting religion. either of advancing or inhibiting. Well, I have a problem with both of those, depending on how you define it, because if not advancing religion means making sure everybody gets some people have a head start. This religion's in the majority. This needs special protection. Wait a minute. How do you do that without inhibiting this one that's succeeding in some way? Okay? So, that's a problem. Those words are way too ill-defined. So in other words, the Establishment Clause was now being read to mitigate the Expression Clause of the First Amendment, probably annihilate it, raising the question that no one has really ever satisfactorily answered. Does the First Amendment violate itself? In order to prevent what one clause of the First Amendment prohibited, courts now saw fit to do what the other clause of the same amendment prohibited. So, that's that. Roe versus Wade, 1973. All 50 states had laws prohibiting abortion. 80% at least of the people did not want it legalized. By a 7-2 majority, a, quote, right to privacy was discovered in the 14th Amendment, where it had never been seen before. If anything, the protection of life, liberty, and property in the states could be read as a constitutional right to life, but certainly not the other way around. So in other words, in the 14th Amendment, you do have, with due process, protection of life, something already in the Constitution to defend life. You certainly don't have anything like a right. Now, that's just the right to privacy. Now, I can see reading that into things like the First Amendment and other such amendments, but you have to read it in. It's not there. But then in 1992, I think it was Casey versus Planned Parenthood, Sandra Day O'Connor wrote the majority opinion, and she actually, in addition to discovering a right to privacy, she discovered a right to define one's own, the mystery of one's own existence. Ah, I think she found it, because that is a freaking mystery. I don't know what she just said. What did she just say? The mystery of one's own existence? What does that mean? What does that mean? And where? And which amendment is that in? Help me understand the meaning of the mystery of your own existence. What is that? Shirley MacLaine? What is that? Sorry. Romer versus Evans, 1996. This was the end of the 1992 backlash in Colorado against the special rights being granted to homosexuals, namely in protecting them against the violation of rights that did not exist. Remember, the job of courts, don't get all emotional, the job of courts is only to interpret the existing laws. If you want a new law, amend the Constitution. If you think the people in your state are knuckle-draggers, move to another state. That's the way law works. That's the way law works. You are setting up a fascist principle. You are not the special right. Okay, if you're going to erode the meaning and the function of the three branches of government to do this, that is beyond a special right to a fascist state. It doesn't matter you're not thinking through that. Well, that, they're not wanting all that. No doubt most Germans did not want all the things that Adolf Hitler eventually did. But if it has that effect, it matters little. Well, with an increasing amount of lawsuits and special right witch hunts against private photographers for turning down a job at a lesbian wedding, and that was in the case of Willock versus Elaine Photography in 2008, sued because he would not, in his private business, lend his services to a homosexual wedding. He was sued, and he lost. A church for refusing to rent their facilities to a gay union. And the like. The voters of Colorado passed an amendment which prevented the state and local governments from awarding such rights. It was not a taking away of rights homosexuals had. It was preventing that. So originally Christians had this right. So another thing I was saying to my libertarian friends, I know what Christians have done in the last 10 years, turning a blind eye to the Patriot Act and stuff like that, but don't let your emotion rewrite history. Okay? The Supreme Courts agreed with the appeal against this, that the citizens of the state had no right to make this decision for themselves. This was above all a matter of states' rights, and the court ruled 6-3 that the states have no such rights, where, as Justice Kennedy, this is why the states don't have a right to pass this amendment. According to Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, stated, it lacks a rational relationship to legitimate state interests. Yes. So, if I have a Bible on hand, which Bible contains Levitical laws against homosexuality. If I'm walking on public property, you can stop me and confiscate my Bible. And I cannot appeal to the state because, quote, it lacks a rational relationship to legitimate state interests. The state interests are my interests, defending my life, liberty, and property. You cannot steal my stuff because you think that the stuff in my stuff is irrational and violates the mystery of one's own existence. These aren't judges, these are Fruit Loops. They're fascist Fruit Loops. I'm going with that. Fascist Fruit Loops. I like the sound of that. Anyway, Boy Scouts of America et al. Versus Dale, 2000. The Boy Scouts are a private club in the sense of being a free assembly with constitutional rights to define their own purposes. You may not agree with those purposes, but they are a private assembly nevertheless. The court argued that they are, quote, a public accommodation. A public accommodation? What the heck does that mean? In the same way as my pockets are a public accommodation? Well, we wouldn't say that. Well, your boy Clinton did. He said, tonight I'd ask for a contribution. Meaning confiscation of my money. But this is worse. They're a public accommodation. If the scouts are compelled, forced, to hire a homosexual, and they are not at the same time free to teach against that particular behavior, as it would at least send a mixed message that they felt would have jeopardized their purpose, regardless if you agree or disagree with their purpose. That is part of their right to assemble, namely the right to abstain from assembling with others, particularly others in leadership in their organizations that will then define their organization a different way. By a 5-4 majority, the original right to assembly was upheld. 5-4. That's close.
Too close.
5-4 agree that the First Amendment is still a legitimate thing. 4 fascists. Aren't you glad that Kennedy is that 5th vote when he says that these things lack a rational relationship to legitimate state interests? Makes me feel better. Well, what would the ramifications have been if it was not? Well, for one thing, no Christian organization, including churches, would long be protected from being forced to admit anyone who disagreed with their statements of faith. The court was one vote away from annihilating a good portion of the First Amendment. So whatever one feels about the relationship between the state and marriage, the fact of the matter is that the recent legal changes on same-sex marriage are all unlawful because the courts have written those laws. The issue, first and foremost, is whether the court is a legislative branch. In the case of Massachusetts in 2003 and in Iowa in 2009, the constitutional right of the state was cited above the will of the people, yet neither constitution mentions anything about marriage, much less same-sex marriage anywhere. Citing equal protection clauses is immaterial, since legal protection is precisely protection against one's actual legal rights being violated, not the invention of new ones against the will of the people. Speaking of which, let me see if I can find this in here. I have an article. Where do I have this? Tell me I didn't bring it. Ah, you dirty. I didn't. Anyway. Well, I'll paraphrase it. It was about a month ago it was not in the Idaho Statesman. Maybe it was. Who knows? Anyway, in California, there was a recent ruling against ex-homosexual ministries. In other words, Christian ministries in Northern California are now not able to give that particular form of therapy of calling it a sin. In other words, they're not allowed to call that a conversion. You're not allowed to be converted from homosexuality to Christianity. So the courts are not saying that you can't convert to Christianity, but they are saying that you can't call that movement from homosexuality to Christianity a conversion. May I strongly suggest that this is a first step towards saying that you cannot convert to Christianity? I'm just throwing that out there. This is a real court ruling in the last couple of months. Okay? And there's other things. Let's move beyond that for a second. What remedies do judges and the people have? Well, in his chapter on the courts and the question of ultimate power in a nation, Grudem on more than one occasion says that the citizens of the United States have, listen carefully how he says this. I think he's trying to scare us in a good way, but I don't want to take his words too literally true here because I'm going to call them into question here. The citizens of the United States have absolutely no power to overcome these rulings. Now, I take it from the title of his chapter and his suggestion that the nomination of judges is the basic issue in each election. He's engaging in a kind of rhetorical provocation. At least that's my hopeful interpretation of his meaning. If, on the other hand, he really believes that in such literal terms, we have no remedy, I beg to differ. It is true that the system of checks and balances has broken down, but we must again distinguish between the essence and the expressions of the law. For one thing, Congress has a very legal interest in its own survival and therefore its own defense. Article 1, Section 1 clearly states that, quote, all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States, which shall consist of the Senate and House of Representatives. In other words, on our chart, the highest law of the land says, all crafting of new law shall belong to these guys, which consists of this and this. Period. That's the law. These guys are breaking the law. They're breaking the law. I don't know how else to say that. They're breaking the law. So remedies are a fixing of that violation of the law. Okay, so that's the first thing we can say right there. So let's look at how this shapes out, the shape of people's grievance. What's going on here by judicial fiat, that's really what we mean by it. These planners, these progressives, are making law from the bench. They're putting into law, writing into law, things that do not exist in law, under their jurisdiction. Okay? That is illegal. That's illegal. It's a violation of the law, and they ought to be thrown in prison. At the very least, they ought to be thrown in prison. That's our first remedy. And so the moment you say, but we can't do that for XYZ, and you're citing pragmatic and practical and power reasons, and I get that, I agree with you, but can you at least admit the first thing I say? Let's start with that. If I'm talking to somebody, that's the first thing I want to find out if they're really a relativist at heart. Do you at least agree that what they're doing is illegal? And if so, let's start with that. Okay? I skipped this Grudem. Well, Grudem says this basically about the current situation. At present, Anthony Kennedy is in effect deciding by himself many of the important issues facing our nation. He can side with whichever group he chooses, and they will have a majority. Therefore, many of the important issues facing the nation are decided by one man who was never elected to office. And so Grudem's point is, in the cases that matter most, because they're the ones that have been given to us by judicial fiat and that have not been overturned, Anthony Kennedy, at that point, is pretty much the ruler of the world. Now, I'm putting that in slightly, but I don't know how else to understand Grudem's statement. And I agree with him. It's just that when you say it like that, you're, oh, don't say it like that, Matt. Okay, how is what I'm saying different than what Grudem's saying? Okay? So, people don't like the truth, and they'll play with it, they'll pet it, they'll feed it a little bit until it makes a mess all over the floor. And what I'm saying is, hey, look, there's some stuff on the floor there. Let's clean that up. And so who hates truth here, if that's a problem? All right. The mythical separation of church and state is one example of how this is strategically aimed at the free exercise of political involvement. It's a political power issue. It's not simply bad constitutional law. It's an act of extermination on the political life of those who are part of that demographic called the church. It is a legal tactic, precisely aimed to annihilate the legal remedies of Christians as Christians. It is a denial of political speech and rights across the board to say that one group cannot have them to the degree that such speech and rights derive from, quote, religious principles. Every conviction of the Christian comes from our faith, and we recognize, even if they don't, that every right we have descends from what they would regard to be a, quote, religious source. Consequently, according to this logic, the Christian may only exist in the public square if and when he is ready to renounce his entire faith. That is the logical consequence of this, even if some don't think it out. Moreover, it is not simply the political existence of the Christian that the courts influence. So you might see that and say, fine, then we won't have a political existence. But that's not necessarily idolatry. Okay? You know, as if there's some separate existence than our public existence. See, that says something about our theology and what we think the nature of Christianity is. The consequences of the anti-Christian rulings of the court are felt in areas of the church's life not usually regarded as political, such as the home life, private association, business practices, education, and yes, even elements of the church's mission, as much as we'd like to separate one from the other. Now, at the end of the day, the focal point of legal remedies is the law itself. Grudem correctly interprets Romans 13, correctly applies Romans 13 to the judicial situation of our day. Listen to Grudem, he gets it right. I'm glad. Most evangelicals don't. This is what he says. Quote, Romans 13:1 says, let every person be subject to the governing authorities. In the system of government established in the United States, the highest governing authority is a document, the Constitution itself, end quote. Grudem is rare here in not being a relativist. Most evangelicals are not willing to apply the clear meaning of scriptures here to the clear meaning of the laws of our land. If you're not going to be a relativist about Romans 13, in other words, you can't have it both ways. If I say, oh, Romans 13, to the Roman governor or to Caesar, well, that's easy. Caesar doesn't exist, and I'm not a Roman citizen. So I guess I don't have to apply Romans 13. Oh, no, 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 the Pietist says. You have to apply it to your context that you're in. Okay, well, let's show you how you have it the other way. Fine, let's apply it to the situation we're in. Here's the situation we're in. Oh, no, 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 you can't. I'm sorry, which way do you want it, relativist, fascist? You're a fascist. You're a swastika kisser. You want it both ways. But the main thing you want at all costs is to worship Hitler. That's what you can't wait for. Oh, I've never thought about it that way. I don't think about that. It doesn't matter whether you think about it or not. I say, let's let Romans 13 speak fully to our actual situation. The shape of judicial review. The principle of nullification is that, quote, since the Constitution prescribes the powers of those who govern, if they exceed those prescribed, they are acting without warrant and their acts are of no effect. That is from Carson's Basic American Government. Since the Constitution prescribes the powers of those who govern, if they exceed those prescribed, they are acting without warrant and their acts are of no effect. Now you might say, ah, rebel rousing. No, he's just saying they're breaking the law. That's all he's saying. They're violating the law. They're just, unlike a lot of other thieves who, you know, when a thief goes into your house, he doesn't pull up a copy of the law and call C-SPAN and pretend it's a legislative act. He's just robbing your stuff. Nevertheless, if somebody does do that, they're still robbing your stuff. They're still violating the law. The difference is that in addition to that, they're desecrating the law and pretending that the law says that that's a good thing. That doesn't make it lawful. When somebody who's holding a piece of paper and pretending it's the law and calls C-SPAN does it, he's just as guilty, and I would say more so, of breaking the same laws as the guy who's not calling C-SPAN and pretending that's the law. Whoever's breaking the law needs to be held accountable to justice according to the law, not according to a mob. By the way, you're violating the Ninth Commandment. You will not speak false witness against your neighbor. Evangelicals who are pietists, you can't be a pietist without violating the Ninth Amendment, or the Ninth Commandment. You cannot say that this is what we're saying when people from the beginning have said the opposite. So did Calvin, by the way, in his doctrine of the chapter 20 of book 4 of the Institutes, when he talked about the lower magistrate. Now, you can say Calvin's wrong. You can say the Founding Fathers are wrong. You can say that I'm wrong. But when you say, you mean the mob, when what we mean is the law, that's slander. You're telling a falsehood. You know, grown adults are saying, no, that's not what I mean. And you're saying, yes, it is. You want to get flame torches and pitchforks and you know, all these things. That's slander. That's not cool. But more than not cool, it's a violation of God's law. You're lying about your brothers and sisters. That's mean-spirited. It's wicked. Okay, so I want to help you and stop sinning like that against your brothers and sisters. If you're a pietist, you're sinning. You're sinning against your brothers and sisters. You're saying that they believe in mob justice when in fact they're being very clear. You may not understand them, but you're slandering. if you choose to be simple-minded, at least have the humility to say, well, I really don't understand what you're talking about, and stay out of the discussion as your philosophy dictates. But don't slander your brothers and sisters because you're uncomfortable with what they're saying. Just say, I don't really understand what you're saying. Don't say, you're a mobster and stuff like that. That's slander. That's a violation of the Ninth Commandment. All right. Nullification. No one more famously argued this principle in American history than John Calhoun of South Carolina in the generation prior to the Civil War. And if you don't trust his argument, I'd mention I had a Hamilton quote. Even an arch-federalist such as Alexander Hamilton could say at the very beginning, no legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. Hamilton said that. Hamilton, that arch-federalist who made the case, and Madison did most of the writing in the Federalist Papers to appeal to people to do this, but Hamilton said, no legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. To deny this would be to affirm that the deputy is greater than his principal, that the servant is above his master, the representatives of the people superior to the people themselves, that men acting by virtue of powers may do not only what their powers do not authorize, but what they forbid. Now you can say, Hamilton's off his rocker. Now by the time you're saying that, your argument amounts to this. That the people, and now, because these statements are not part of the Constitution, they're explanations of, they're commentaries. In a sense, the Federalist Papers, Jefferson's letter to that Baptist church in Connecticut, things like that, those are commentaries on the Constitution. But if it starts to pile up, if they're all saying the same thing, and you choose to say, well, Adams is off his rocker, well, Madison didn't know what he was talking about, Hamilton didn't know what he's talking about. Yeah, but they're all saying the same thing, and they're all saying, what this document means, in case you didn't get the memo, is that we the people are creating this Constitution and everything inside that, including statutory law, exists within that framework. So that even the person who you'd least expect it, Hamilton, is saying, no legislative act, therefore, contrary to the Constitution, can be valid. The principle of nullification is not something John Calhoun brought after the fact. The principle of the nullification is the very principle of the Constitution. The Constitution assumes nullification. They just nullified, and which is to say that they recognized the nullification of British imperialism and the British attack on their rights under the English Constitution. That was, in a sense, an act of peaceable and police, eventually, nullification. You don't understand either the Constitution or the principle of nullification if you choose to say, to statement after statement by the people that created the Constitution, they didn't know what they're talking about. So you have the right to violate the law then? Don't look now, but who's the lawbreaker? You're saying about the highest law of the land by the people that wrote it, that is of no account. How is it that you think we're in violation of Romans 13 when you're saying about the people that wrote it, in volume after volume of statement to the contrary, they don't know what they're talking about, therefore that's not the law? That is not only relativism, that's anarchy. That is anarchy. The Christian evangelical is a fascist anarchist. He's a relativistic fascist anarchist. And he wants us to disobey the law by disbelieving the principle of nullification. Even the word secession is not an accurate word, in a sense, to describe what this nullification is. So, the legitimacy of the American Revolution follows from this. Governmental legitimacy is rooted in this. The American Revolution was biblically justified because the British state, at least in its motion toward the colonies, had dissolved the bonds of that covenant. The law which stood over both the crown and its subjects had been disobeyed by the state officials, and thus the lower magistrates, not the mob, I know the British called them the mob, but the lower magistrates in the colonies upheld the law, and the lawbreakers were prosecuted via military campaign. It was a police action by duly appointed assemblies. The tyranny of unlawful governments may be opposed by competing magistrates whose office is also lawful. This may be done by one sovereign power protecting its borders from the unlawful force of another sovereign power, or it may be done by a lower magistrate or officer fulfilling those duties that are within his lawful jurisdiction, as you see with Sheriff Joseph Apayo doing right now in Arizona. In our day, it is still the highest source of federal law. And I'm going to quote Amendment 9 and 10. This is the law. This isn't just a law. It's the highest law of the land. If you are against nullification, you would have me disobey the highest law of the land. You are a relativistic anarchist. You are the mobster. Amendment 9. The enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people. So that's the first qualification. 9 and 10 are qualifications, exclamation points on the whole system of exclamation points called amendments. The 9th Amendment is saying, if you think there's something in this document that nullifies the rights precisely where the rights come from, the people in the states, don't go there. The 9th Amendment is saying, you interpret this document wrong if you've interpreted it in that way. The 10th Amendment follows that by saying, quote, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, hello, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution constitutes, what's the other C word I'm looking for? Contract, compact, constitutes, charters, thank you. The document charters the offices, not the other way around. Who says so? The document says so! Not the commentaries on the document. The document itself says this is the law. You're breaking it. You're a violation of Romans 13. I will not join you in your idolatry. I will not join you in your violation of the law. I will not join you in being a lawbreaker. This is the law. It says the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Those words mean something. The Constitution charters those offices, not the other way around. I will not join you in your lawbreaking. Nor prohibited by it to the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. What does it mean to reserve those rights to themselves? It means that they inherently possess those rights. They're the ones that created the Constitution and chartered these offices. These offices don't get to take that, turn it inside out, and reserve to themselves whatever rights they want, when the very law is saying, anything not in here that we forgot, you can't do that either, unless we amend the Constitution and grant to you those as well. The people are granting to these public servants certain duties. If they step beyond that or neglect to do those, they are in violation of the law. It is a lawful prosecution of the lawbreakers to bring them to justice. A mob? Not a mob. Local people getting there at the conies of their brains on straight and doing like that sheriff is, following the law according to what the law, what his office is in the states and the locales. And if you say, well, his job is exactly what the Pope says it is. I mean, not the Pope, the judge. Well, then you are a relativist. And relativism has moral consequences. It makes moral monsters. Consequently, the governments of the states may lawfully resist, even by armed force, the unlawful force brought against their jurisdiction. It is illegal for the central government to be doing anything that the people have not expressly delegated to them from that higher form of government in the federal system called the states. What is unique about our system of government, again, chartered by that paper, not in theory, it's the law. What's unique about this system of government is simply that the lower magistrates, as Calvin called them, the constituents of the federal system, are actually higher magistrates in terms of authority on that piece of paper, according to that law. This is not theoretical. It's what the document says repeatedly, so that you get the point. The states are responsible to bring the lawbreakers to justice by peaceable judicial means, if at all possible, until a full state of war ensues. And then they must defend their life, liberty, and property accordingly. Where the mediating magistrates act as cowards or ignoramuses, the populace may inform them that the powers of all such magistrates are derived by the consent of the governed. Indeed, this consent is an expression of each individual's life, liberty, and property, and is this natural right and nothing else that has instituted each level of government as expressed in the laws themselves. Again, we the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and to our posterity, do ordain. So take out the rest for a second. We the people of the United States, dot, dot, dot. He's going to tell you this is the reason we're doing it. Do is a continuous thought. It's one sentence. Do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. We the people, for these reasons, do ordain this setup, do ordain these offices to protect only these things that we're delegating down to it from the states. I don't know how else to say it. Hence, the right of armed police action belongs to the people in the formation of a state where the former civil government has broken down. Not as a mob, in the formation of a new state where the former civil government has broken down. This is the fundamental reason why the American Revolution was justified and, in fact, mandated under biblical principles. The citizens of the colonies did not revolt against a legitimate state, but the lower magistrates and people performed a defensive police action against a rogue state that had broken down into a state of war. Thus, in Romans 13 terminology, the crown had abdicated its sword and played the rebel, at which point the lawbreakers of London were brought to justice for their barbarous activity. It's important to note, first, that the representatives of the American colonies sought remedies peacefully for a whole decade, according to English law. Over that decade that spans the intolerable acts of the 1760s. And second, that the British anarchists invaded a portion of the citizens from which they derived their authority. Thus, the Patriots' resistance was a defensive police action meeting all the standards of the just use of force. Their life, liberty, and property was assaulted without just cause. And the police brought the criminals to justice. According to law, which, by the way, here's another mistake, according to English law even. If you think the difference between the American Constitution and the British Constitution is that one totally overturned the old order that was a Christian order, or at least informed by Christianity, and now we believe and have a just government based on life, liberty, and property, whereas before that was just the old knuckle-dragging way to do it. No, the problem was, they said, that these truths were already truths. We're instituting a government that more expressly says that in a written constitution, but they were appealing to rights they had as Englishmen. Now, they may have, you can say they're wrong, but that would be a tough case to make. Stinking phone, I should have turned it off earlier. Anyway, I was only going to add one more thing. Whatever you think about the motivations in the heart of those who instigated the revolution, and whatever you think of all the sources from which the founders constructed the Constitution, the whole thing was really a remarkable thing that still is a remarkable thing. Madison concluded about both the Revolution and the Constitutional Convention, quote, "It is impossible for a man of pious reflection not to perceive in it a finger of that almighty hand which has been so frequently and signally extended to our relief in the critical stages of the Revolution." There's a new book out that's just a long line of things, and there might be some true things in it. But again, this trend now to consider the Founding Fathers not merely deist, or at least sufficiently deistic, and so on and so forth. But I think when you look at Madison's quote, where some evangelicals today would go back there and wag their fingers at them for being so deistic, or at least secular, I think they would say to us today that maybe you're being arrogant. Maybe us attributing this to divine providence, in spite of our many flaws, is a much more biblical position than always fomenting. I would say, where's the foam on the mouth collecting more? Among the American revolutionaries, or among this very thoughtless and highly arrogant class of evangelicals today? Highly arrogant, judging everyone in the past by the standards of a bunch of people whose highest moral act in life is to sit on the stinking couch and do nothing and criticize everybody else and pretend that everybody else is doing that.